Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. After this segment from Sean Swain, you'll hear our interview with James Tracy on struggles around housing access, displacement, gentrification, and resistance in San Francisco. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We'll come like a bomb! Sometimes bad news is good news. When you come to the conclusion that reform is action is impractical, unreasonable, and futile, it doesn't foreclose on resisting completely. Every steel door that's slammed shut should always provoke us to contemplate how to cut the bars out of the windows. Slamming the steel door of reformism liberates us to consider direct action, which is what anarchists want to do in the first place. In the prison context, that again leads back to a discussion of the Army of the 12 Monkeys. Now, before going any further, please keep in mind that I was sent to the super-duper, uber-mega-ultra-hyper-turbo-max on the pretext of being a creator of the Army of the 12 Monkeys, an accusation I have consistently denied. My counsel, Richard Kerger, has recently filed a civil action, Swain v. Moore, now posted at SeanSwain.org, challenging this frame-up. Having said that, I was a witness to what occurred at Mansfield Correctional when the Army of the 12 Monkeys happened, and I think I'm fairly qualified to present an analysis of what this event implies for anarchists and for direct action in and outside of prison. For anyone who hasn't heard about the Army of the 12 Monkeys, here's the deal. The Army of the 12 Monkeys distributed flyers and manuals, thousands of them, all over the compound of Mansfield Correctional. These materials promoted a campaign of sabotage with cool-looking graphics and brainstorming lists of all the stuff prisoners could do to make the prison unmanageable. It worked. Prisoners joined in, costing that prison hundreds of thousands of dollars in damage. Just one contract with an outside firm to replace the destroyed plumbing at the chow hall, six figures by itself. 4 months after they emerged, prisoners with organizing materials were still being rounded up, and a riot occurred at a second prison, Lake Erie Correctional, that prison fascists initially admitted was related to the Army of the 12 Monkeys before they denied it. Past is prologue. Some important points for anyone who wants to facilitate direct action resistance and abandon reformist wheel spinning once and for all. First, from what I gather, the 12 Monkeys did not seek reforms on the promise of going back to their assigned seat. They said, prison sucks, let's destroy it. Second, they made no effort from what I saw to explain why prison sucks. No political education, no political action, only promoted action. And third, it appears that the membership equated with action. That is, monkeys are as monkeys do. No central leadership, no membership cards, only an invitation for prisoners to participate. In short, the Army of the 12 Monkeys was everything that reformist wheel spinners are not. And the FBI was on site within 14 days. I recently filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI, asking for all files that contain references to my name and to the Army of the 12 Monkeys. The FBI's initial search yielded 1,297 pages. Do you know how many boxes of crayons they had to have gone through? I want you to consider something. The prisoners who created the Army of the 12 Monkeys, at least the ones I've met, are not exceptional. In fact, ODRC counsel Trevor Clark, Trainwreck Trevor, when interrogating me, read off some of their IQs. Their IQs were, according to Trainwreck, below 100, below average. My point is, at random, you could pick a group of prisoners smarter than the 12 Monkey organizers at any given prison on the planet, and they would be even more capable of brainstorming a list of direct actions and manual than the 12 Monkeys were. Also, I know for more than 13 years at Mansfield Correctional that there was nothing exceptional about that prison, or the circumstances there, or the conditions for revolution that socialists are always screaming about. Mansfield Correctional was ordinary, its staff and administration were ordinary, and the prisoners who created the Army of the 12 Monkeys were ordinary. So based on the 12 Monkey event, if you're an anarchist tired of reformist wheel spinning and sitting on the sideline, you can simply begin direct action. And all you need are ordinary people against an ordinary government, with ordinary staff and an ordinary administration. The only ingredient you have to bring to the table is the imagination to think past reformist failure. To be clear here, I'm not saying you need the 12-month manual. I'm saying you can likely improve upon those. The average person knows how to resist and why, if only provoked to consider it. And I'm not talking about the potential for making a prison unmanageable. I'm talking about making civilization unmanageable. The FBI doesn't have enough crayons to write 1,297 pages on all of us. For Eton, this is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax. So if you're listening, you are the resistance.
You could write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. All right, we're speaking with longtime Bay Area-based housing activist and author James Tracy about his recent book, Dispatches Against Displacement, Field Notes from San Francisco's Housing Wars, which was just released from AK Press. Thanks a lot for coming on, James.
Thanks for having me.
So in the beginning of the book, you make a distinction between gentrification, a buzzword that's been more and more in use of recent, and displacement. What's the difference, and why do you find displacement a more useful word?
Yeah, well, basically, by most definitions, displacement is the end result of gentrification. And, gentrification is a fine word to use. It just, it very simply means the replacement of poor and working class people in a neighborhood with upper class people. It's a fine word. However, the way that it's used is often misused. People tend to use the word gentrification to mean any type of improvement that a neighborhood or any type of change that a neighborhood may experience, and that leaves the door wide open towards defining a little gentrification as a good thing. By using the word displacement, I put the emphasis on the end result, that long-term residents actually have to leave their communities oftentimes, and also de-emphasizing some of the symptoms of gentrification, new cafes, new shops, because certainly we all want to live in neighborhoods that have amenities. And I also want to put the focus on people who are actually doing the big decision making, the real estate industry, the urban planning regimes that different cities have, not the symptoms.
You've been a longtime housing activist in the Bay Area. Can you talk about some of the ways that displacement has gone down, to your understanding, in San Francisco over the last 40 or 50 years?
Yeah, I've been working in the Bay Area where I was born. Since about 1990, around housing and poverty issues, but many of the events that set the stage for the current displacement predate my participation by decades. Most notably, the urban renewal changes, where the federal government empowered local governments to create redevelopment agencies, which completely tore down long-standing neighborhoods. So in San Francisco, that was the Western Addition or the Fillmore, largely African-American community that was completely decimated by redevelopment. That was also Manila Town, which no longer exists, which was the site of the historic International Hotel struggle, which was took over 10 years actually to evict elderly Filipino and Chinese tenants from the last residential hotel in Manila Town. And of course, South of Market. South of Market was redeveloped. At the time, it was largely residential hotels and apartment buildings. The famous Jack Kerouac wrote about it quite eloquently in some of his pieces. It was a kind of a bastion of working class San Francisco. My uncle, who was a member of the Sailors Union of the Pacific, used to live in one of the buildings that was torn down. Currently, there is a monument to Martin Luther King there. And we used to just walk around his former neighborhood, and he would point out all the different places where people used to live. After that, jumping forward to the early 90s, there is the dot-com era, what we call we frame so much of our conversation around displacement around tech today, especially in the Bay Area. In the 90s, when tech was first starting to get its legs, there was a gigantic push towards displacement that went on, as very similar to what we see today. People with far more ability to compete in the marketplace were pouring into the city, and evictions went right through the roof. But one of the things that I really emphasize in Dispatches Against Displacement is that it's not just the market-driven displacement. We also saw the privatization of public housing in San Francisco through the Hope 6 program. And we also saw the deregulation of cities' ability to provide rent control to renters as contributing. It wasn't just an accident of new people arriving here.
And those two things that you mentioned, concerning public housing subsidies, the Hope 6, that was a federal program, right?
Yeah, the Hope 6 program basically tore down public housing, rebuilt it, but in most cases nationwide with far less units than were originally there. So that in itself was a form of displacement. Add to that the restrictive new regulations on who could live in public housing, and you had many developments all across the country. No more than 20 or 30% of people returning to their homes, with some exceptions. Some cities did way better than others as far as preventing displacement and actually rebuilding these communities for the communities, but most completely failed.
So there's the people displaced by the changes that have come from up top in terms of what's available to them. There's a phrase that you use in the book. It was a spatial deconcentration. Can you talk about how that concept played into the decision of the Clinton administration to change subsidies for low-income folks?
Yeah, the concept of spatial deconcentration is really fascinating. It's basically the process of pushing working-class communities out of the cities and pushing people back up to the suburbs, to the rim cities. It was once viewed very much as a conspiracy theory that after the great uprisings of the 1960s and 1970s, popularly known as urban riots, but also the community organizing pushes through the Black Panthers and the Brown Berets and groups like that, that the system got very scared and said, "We're going to figure out how to push people far away from each other so they can't organize like that anymore. They can't call into question in an organized way racism and sexism and inequality." That may or may not have been true. It may or may not have been an actual conspiracy theory coming from the Kerner report. I have no idea. But what I do know is that the impacts of displacement has created spatial deconcentration, where when people leave their communities in urban areas, they do go out to the rim cities, to the working class suburbs, and it does have a distinct impact on people's ability to organize. Very often, simply because people are still working in the cities that they were displaced from. So, simply the commute time means that you don't have time to show up to a neighborhood meeting, and it has a very very pacifying impact.
Can you talk a little bit about what redevelopment agencies are and how they played into, say, urban renewal in the 1960s and 70s and the effects that it had on populations of color?
Yeah. So like I said, during the during the 1960s and 1970s, but even a little bit before that, the federal government told local governments that you could create things called redevelopment agencies that were kind of autonomous, quasi-governmental agencies that had the ability to use eminent domain. Eminent domain is the process where the government can come in and take away private property, mow it down, and redevelop it. And it happened for many reasons. Some were for to reorder the racial housing patterns to reinforce segregation. Oftentimes, in more liberal cities, it was used to build up the tax base, to build up the tax increment. If you took down a bunch of residential hotels and you put up a Marriott hotel or a Hilton hotel, certainly more tax money would come into the city, of course. One of the interesting things about urban renewal is that even though we see it largely as a conservative effort, both progressives and conservative policy people supported it, for very different reasons. But liberals and progressives really supported it at the time. I don't think that there was a Democratic senator or a Democratic city that opposed redevelopment because of the hopes for doing slum clearance and the idea that government could be the sole way the sole method, for improving communities. And time and time again, when government wants to come in and improve communities without any sort of community input, you see the displacement story happen over and over again.
In your view, what place do new residents play in displacement? Can you talk about race, culture, class, social mobility, and how the new neighbors fit in?
Absolutely, and I should preface this by saying that we never want cities to get to the point where nobody new can ever show up, right? We want cities, we love cities because they're dynamic. We love cities because people seek refuge there, whether you're fleeing a death squad in El Salvador or the impacts of NAFTA or homophobia somewhere, and the fact that new people can arrive in cities is actually a beautiful thing that we want to preserve. But when the types of changes that we see with the displacement engines happen, then new affluent people are put in the position very similar to, I would say, the early pioneers, where you come to a new area, a new city, looking for opportunities, oftentimes blind to what was there before, oftentimes blind to your own role in the displacement engine. So, for newcomers that are somewhere within what we now call the 99%, it's part of a game. It's part of the game where we're all pitted against each other for the same scarce amount of space, the same scarce amount of rentals and housing opportunities. So that's a very, very different dynamic than people who are coming to a city with a gigantic amount of economic privilege and economic resources and can completely redefine a neighborhood. So on one hand, I always believe that we should always hate the game and not the player. We should always make sure that we target the real estate industry, the banking industry, because these are people who are truly calling the shots. It's not it's not the D-class A artist. It's not the punk rocker. It's not the hipster with their vegan donuts and funny beards and everything. They may be symptoms of the problem, but ultimately we have to figure out ways to move the majority against the minority. However, and this just happened 2 days ago in San Francisco, you do see a lot of race and class baggage coming in. There is a situation, a park in San Francisco, where it's always been used by youth of color and local folks for pickup soccer games. You show up, you pick up a game against people that are there, and it's very kind of, And it's a system that's worked. Now, currently, the wonderful Park and Recs Department of San Francisco has instituted an app reservation system for this park, for the soccer fields. And there was a gigantic and videotaped, and it's making its rounds on the internet, interaction between old Mission District youth and the new arrivals. And you very, very quickly saw the race and class antagonisms and arrogance that go along with many of the individuals of gentrification. But what's most important is to actually build the type of political movements that change people's minds about their own roles, that de-emphasize the individual roles and makes people want to participate and want to fight for the for the human right of housing, regardless of where they started off, regardless of whether it challenges their own advantages and their own privileges in the game. And that can only be only be done when the people who are most impacted are really central to the fight and active and calling the shots and defining the political demands. And then there's space for the rest of us to react to that and to contribute and support.
Much of the book goes through an alphabet soup of various groupings attempting to resist eviction and displacement, much of it in the Mission District, a historically Latino neighborhood in San Francisco. In Chapter 3, you talk a good deal about the experiences of the MAC, the Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition, throughout the 1990s, the late 90s and into the 2000s. Can you talk about the structure and purpose of MAC at the beginning? How did that change as the years passed, and how did that relate to its interventions into electoral politics in San Francisco?
Absolutely. So the Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition was really groundbreaking in many ways. MAC, as we called it, brought together many, many different people that had been doing honorable work around displacement, but walking separately. And it created, created kind of a game-changing conversation in San Francisco around displacement and gentrification that really hadn't been seen for quite a while. For all of a sudden, it became very, very common for the media to actually talk about the impacts of displacement on regular long-term San Franciscans, and in portraying these stories very sympathetically. So, MAC was gigantic, and extremely important. For a while, it was almost every single last week there was a direct action. There was a landlord visit, there was a sit-in somewhere, and mass mobilizations, and it was very eclectic. You had newer homeowners in the mix, working directly alongside and supporting day laborers. Had residential hotel tenants, and it was quite a feat, and it definitely changed the entire conversation around displacement in San Francisco in the late 90s and early 2000s. But it was a coalition, as the name implies, of organizations, but also many individuals participated.
Helped at least to get folks elected into city supervisor positions, right? How did, yeah. As it started interacting more on an electoral level, how did that change the dynamics within the group, and how did it relate internally to itself?
Well, MAC operated on an electoral level for many reasons, most of which were quite good, actually. We had the return of district elections, so for the first time in many years in San Francisco, it was possible to elect people with decent politics to the Board of Supervisors. And the way that San Francisco's politics are structured, the Board of Supervisors actually yields an enormous amount of power around land use. Things that are decided at the Planning Commission around development can actually be appealed directly to the Board of Supervisors, which is somewhat unusual in comparison to many other cities. So, you know, people saw the opportunity to blunt the impacts of gentrification and deal honestly with the way that things, the way that power was actually being dealt with in San Francisco, the actual political economy of San Francisco. Unfortunately, what happened is that we're a little bit too successful. Now, so MAC contributed to a citywide push to get rid of some extremely knee-jerk pro-development board of supervisors. It was called the Progressive Sweep of 2000. Only one MAC member actually took office, then Supervisor Chris Daley. And but we had enormous access, you know, for all, you know, for a bunch of people who were very used to marching in the streets, to storming meetings with the Planning Commission, to doing all of the kind of extra parliamentary stuff in the activist repertoire. All of a sudden, we had the entire Board of Supervisors on our speed dials because they were generally people who had been activists in various neighborhoods. And we never really fully grappled with what that meant. With so much important legislation that was actually possible at that point, everything went into City Hall. And you know, well, like I say in the book, you know, we had an opportunity to fight with two fists. You know, to increase the street agitation and the direct action, but also work with people who are willing to put positive measures, you know, forward inside, having an actual inside-outside strategy. And with some exceptions of some very interesting campaigns that happened, it was a really missed opportunity to make a new model of urban politics.
To dig into that project a little bit more from a different angle, you talk a bit about the conflicts around race, representation, both within the group and in its vision of the Mission District, and class that caused much strife in MAC's later days. What sorts of things were happening and what lessons need to be learned from it?
Yeah, I think that most of the solutions to racial and ethnic differences within organizations are structural. They're not, you know, but there's not very many individual solutions. There's structural decisions that need to be made and issues to be grappled with around the ways that organizations actually and coalitions actually function with each other. So of course the mission district was largely Latino, and its politics had a very strong Latino current going back to the 1960s and 1970s. So with Latino displacement being so incredibly front and center and such an incredible reality, of course there was a very understandable and supportable push to make sure that Latino voices, that the voices of poor people, in particular, and long-term working class people, were front and center in the fight. And of course, that's 100% valid. We had a lot of folks of European descent, which of course I am one, who came in there and didn't understand these needs and just said that. That any type of talk about race, racial realities, were just distracting from the potential to build a broad united front, a broader movement, and of course it played out because many of the organizations that were, you know, pushing for racial justice that were bringing up these issues were, you know, nonprofit organizations doing fantastic work, and many of the people who were who were critiquing this were individual white people who didn't exactly know where they fit into the whole conversation. And normally it turned into dissension. So certainly we need urban politics that deal with deal with both the divisions and the possible unities between people in the 99%. But we can't build racially blind or even racially arrogant movements. Now, for example, one of the gentlemen that that I referred to actually came to a protest with a sign that says, "If it's brown, flush it down," which was referring to our very horrible mayor at the time, Willie Brown, who was the first African-American mayor of San Francisco. Now, even though Mayor Brown's politics, especially around displacement, were reprehensible, we shouldn't have had to explain to this activist why bringing such a sign to a to a rally was going to further divide people around racial lines that were just starting to work with one another. All of a sudden, the people that were asking him to take down the sign were either racist or too PC, which is ridiculous.
More with James Tracy about housing crises in San Francisco after this musical break.
Can't give up. Baby, don't cry. Hope you got your head up. Even when the road is hard, never give up. Baby, don't cry. Hope you got your head up. Even when the road is hard, never give up.
Around page 48 of Dispatches Against Displacement, you give a critique of how many leftist organizations and organizers that are white-led attempt to interface with people marginalized by class, race, gender, ability, sexuality, and other oppressions. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. In the book, I was actually talking about an organization that was not white-led, that was actually... actually, its leadership was actually multiracial, but the class divisions were quite pronounced. And what I noticed during this time, not just in this organization, but in the movement, that there was a really interesting and kind of destructive polarity around poverty in our movement, in the conversations about poverty. On one hand, you had had this idea that was kind of very mutated version of lumpen proletariat theory, that poor people didn't really have any type of self-organization capacity at all, and needed to basically be led by middle class organizers and of course that's ridiculous, and we have in the history of the United States, most of the most powerful movements that we have the leadership of poor people in it. But then you also had this other very strange and very counterproductive impulse that said that poor people, by virtue of surviving poverty, just had all of the answers, right? And could never make any mistakes at all. And I think that speaks volumes about kind of like the within the left, within progressive movements, of how confused we can get on the issues of poverty. In the organization that I'm focusing on, the Mission Agenda, we were never really able to bridge this and to deal with the very real impacts of trauma that many people had in the organization, and really operated a lot more like a vanguard party or a trade union in the amount of very extremely demanding things that were asked to people without any ever space just to deal and unpack with a lot of the consequences of being kind of in under the boot of inequality in San Francisco in a rapidly gentrifying city. And groups like Hospitality Houses Hold program are really, I think today are they're really pushing forward a new model where the expectation, it's not just an encounter group you know, holds fantastic because it does push people to act politically and to end poverty, but it also gives people a chance and the tools to also deal with trauma. And so it's not an either or thing. I think that that's going to be, you know, one of the models that we're going to see that could actually set quite a precedent within anti-poverty organizations.
HOLD stands for Healing, Organizing, and Leadership Development, right? And you talk a little bit in the book about Joe Wilson from that group and some of the concepts that he brings out concerning trauma and organizing. Can you talk about what Joe Wilson points to in terms of trauma for, like, among organizers and among people suffering from those multiplicities of oppressions?
In therapy, in progressive therapy, whether it be harm reduction or more individual counseling approaches, there's an idea that empowerment of the individual is kind of the prerequisite for healing. And what Joe Wilson is really, one of my heroes in the movement, really teaches people is that empowerment of the community, and the context and the ability for people to transform pain through collective action is also, can also be healing, and if it's done correctly, right? If it's done in a way that gives people the time and the space to create community solutions, that can also contribute to the health of the individual and vice versa.
One of the big issues that people have been reacting to greatly in the last two periods of displacement in San Francisco has been a relationship between tech and software industries in these crises. And you touched on that earlier with the question about what are the moving forces behind it. How did .com play out in the mid-90s versus the current, I think you were calling it Tech 2.0, is that right?
Yeah, so how does that play out? You know, in one way, it's very similar. You know, it comes down to income inequality. And I should preface this by saying that I believe that even if we didn't have high-tech-fueled displacement during these two periods in the Bay Area, we would have still had displacement. The engines of economic equality would have found a different vehicle to rear its head. So it's really important not to simply see this as a tech fueled displacement. It is, but what lies behind it is the economic inequality. When a small portion of the population can actually warp the entire market for everybody, and that's what's really fueling the displacement. So in the 1990s, there was the demonization of the yuppie, right? It was the yuppies are coming to take your housing, and there's certainly a lot of validity to that, but what it does is it individualizes the arguments, right? It opens up the door for the solutions to gentrification being yuppies going home, yuppies becoming better citizens, yuppies making more progressive, enlightened choices at the ballot box. And that's simply, like I said before, not very useful, because what we constantly have to do is expose the roles of the banks, of the real estate industry, of the urban planning regimes, the people that have the true institutional and state power to influence the way that cities are developed and regulated. So currently we have the same, or at least a similar dialogue. Gentrification is because of the tech bros. Gentrification is because of the hipsters. And, tech bros and hipsters have played a fairly destructive role, but they're not the people that are calling the shots in our cities. It does go back to the institutional players.
I know a lot of the reaction that people have towards this more recent .com thing seems to be against city zoning and making deals and choosing to sell city blocks or sell tax breaks to Twitter or Google or Facebook or other companies that are taking up places in south of Market or other parts of the city, or the buses. And I might be reading this incorrectly, but it seems like kind of the manner in which Tech 2.0 is affecting the Bay Area is much more structural rather than what I recall being in high school, at least hearing about the gentrification that was going on in San Francisco around the dot-com. It sounded like a lot of houses were turning into dot-coms. Like basically people were going in and renting or buying up a house that would be residential, but running a startup out of it illegally and thus raising the rent because it was decreasing the amount of available houses on the market and also increasing the amount that people would pay for them in neighborhoods. Is that a misconception?
Well, you're certainly in the neighborhood. So the, you know, what you're referring to is the growth of the live-work move, the live-work dilemma during the 1990s. So, you know, this story basically, you know, is you know, kind of a cautionary tale of be careful for what you ask for when you're putting forward solutions. So, in San Francisco, you know, like many other cities, we saw, you know, the impacts of deindustrialization where many artists were buying up old warehouses and fixing them up and, you know, creating alternative workspaces, things like that, because of, you know, all the old industries were leaving town and, you know, during the 80s. So at the time, the creation of an allowance for live workspaces was a progressive thing to save the housing of low income entrepreneurial artists that were then, when the city would come in and say, oh, you have to, everybody has to get out. This isn't up to code. You can't do that. And artists were being pushed out. So a progressive city supervisor in the 80s, my good friend Harry Britt, put forward a live work ordinance that normalized a lot of these things. It was intended to save people's housing. What the developers found out is that you could quickly exploit the ordinance, and it became very, very profitable to demolish housing and build new live works, to put live work spaces in inappropriate locations where they would drive up the cost of surrounding the surrounding areas of housing, and also circumvent certain payments that developers would have to make for things like schools and infrastructure. So that's that's basically the process that you just described. But yeah, absolutely, Tech 2.0 I believe is going to be far more durable. I'm not saying that there's not going to be a bubble, that the tech is going to continue to push forward, at the same rate that it is. And I think, you know, as we see markets have a way of ebbing and flowing, so to speak. But the current tech industry is far more integrated into the ways that people communicate with one another, even the security apparatuses of the United States, security and surveillance regimes, and also just commerce. So the way that we buy and sell things today and conduct our businesses is far more dependent on tech than it was in the 90s. So it's going to, you know, so for those who think that, oh, this bubble is going to burst and it's going to go away and prices are going to go down just like it did in the in 2003 and 2004, I think that those expectations are really overstated.
So you're a co-founder of the San Francisco Community Land Trust. What is a land trust? How could it relate to founding of a new commons?
So a community land trust is, you know, it's a way of providing housing that is basically safe from the speculative market. A community land trust is an organization that owns the land that is underneath residential housing. It could also be used for, you know, stabilize small businesses. In a community land trust arrangement, the residents own a limited equity share of the building, and the agreements are such that the building can never be used for property speculation. Individuals can't make exorbitant profits by flipping their properties or selling them off. It's solely there to provide affordable housing in perpetuity. I think it's, even though today community land trusts nationwide probably account for, you know, 1% or less of the entire housing stock, it's a massive opportunity to intervene in many different forms of the housing, many different expressions of the housing crises. It can be used to stabilize communities against, foreclosures. Can be used to stop evictions, as we've used in San Francisco. It can be used proactively, which I think is the best use of a community land trust is before a crisis actually hits, when a community starts to use it as a way of planning long term for the good and the development of their community. And by protecting residents against displacement and transferring property from the private market to a new sector, the cooperative sector.
Two things kind of come to mind. It's still up for grabs when it comes to eminent domain, right?
A community land trust cannot protect residents against eminent domain. That's absolutely true, and it can't solve all of the problems in a housing market. What it can do is create substantial amounts of gentrification proof homes that can then be kind of both a base of organizing and a base of community preservation that whose impacts can then ripple out throughout the rest of the market.
The other question was, because of the obvious relationship under capitalism, under racialized patriarchal capitalism, relationship between class and access to money among certain communities, like among certain raced communities, and gender and ability and age, it seems like one could look at the land trust thing and say, oh, well, that's an interesting option for people with social mobility. Like, it sounds like a gated community sort of circumstance. Can you talk about how it's been used by different communities and what sort of folks live in land trust projects?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible to exploit any good solution for bad ends, especially when inequalities around racial and class privileges come to fore and are not dealt with in a programmatic way. However, the community land trust nationwide is largely a working class people of color dominated movement. You have the sawmill community in Albuquerque, which is largely Latino. You have groups in North Carolina that are using this to stabilize African American communities. In San Francisco, our very first building, our very first community land trust, was stabilized a building largely of Chinese immigrants. So, certainly there's many cooperatives, many limited equity cooperatives that that are all white, that are artist based or whatnot. But I think that it's actually a very promising model for stabilizing many different types of communities.
In Chapter 5, you spend a lot of time talking about stances on reform, interaction with the state, prefigurative activity like creating non-alienated housing models and community organizing. What are you positing in terms of a position between reform, prefiguration, and revolution? Or are you?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? So let's start with reform. I believe that reform fights are absolutely 100% necessary in this period of time, mainly because we talk so much about what capital and what the system takes away from each other in terms of material goods, in terms of housing, in terms of our healthcare, in terms of labor. But what we often don't talk about is that what's also stolen is our optimism, is the ability that everyday people can come together and change the conditions that we live in, that we can make alliances with one another, and that history isn't something that's just done to us, but something that we can shape. So that's why I believe that reform fights beyond the honorable goal of just helping people survive in the world actually shows new possibilities that could actually reclaim the populist activism that we need in order to make change. The sense of optimism, and when you see people that at one point thought that change was absolutely impossible, and fight their eviction or help change something, however small, in their community, and then all of a sudden start to think that future changes that are more ambitious and more around restructuring society and getting rid of inequality is possible. That's a very valuable use of reformist politics. A good community organizer says, great, this is what we've accomplished together. What's next? It's always the question of what's next. But a good reformer, as Francis Box Piven once told me, is one that does not kill the movement that it sprung from. And I think that's pretty much the litmus test.
And how do you think what's the relationship between reforms that help empower people or the production of them and prefiguration? Like, it seems like to fight towards, I could see something like housing reform being an important thing to get involved with, or land trusts or something like that, because it saps so much energy from an individual to have to constantly move from house to house or fight against perpetually rising costs of living and rent in cities without rent control. It seems like that sort of prefiguration, or it's not prefiguration, but it's a step towards, it's like activism that's actually working towards potentially solving the problem that's, and you're personally profiting from it in the minute, not monetarily, but in terms of free time or life, maybe.
So, the idea of prefigurative politics is pretty basic. It gets very complicated as different activists and organizers argue about it, but it's pretty basic. That you try to model the world that you would like to live in your activities and your campaigns that you do today. It's very, very basic. And I think there's different forms of prefigurative politics. There's the ones that emphasize, healthy dynamics within an organization, challenging, racial class and gender dynamics that can often mirror the ones of the outside world. There's the prefigurative politics that I call head in the sand prefigurative politics. If we just go and have our autonomous project over here, we don't actually have to deal with the whole rest of the world collapsing around us. And that's extremely, extremely toxic prefigurative politics. But the prefigurative politics that I'm talking about actually borders around building up the potential for dual power. What if we were doing the type of prefiguration that borders on dual power strategies, where we had the ability to win, say, 10,000 units of land trust housing, or creating truly community controlled and community defined health resources, or like they're doing in Cleveland, Ohio, with Evergreen Co-ops, actually, saving workers' jobs by converting to the cooperative sector. That's the really big prefigurative politics that I get most excited about. Even though it's getting to that point means creating healthy organizations and empowering meetings and good internal practices, but I'm also looking to the time where we're actually putting forward grand examples of another city is actually possible.
What overlaps do you see between struggles around housing autonomy in communities and self-stewardship and struggles against racism, sexism, ableism, and class in the U.S.?
Well, that's a long list, the pat answer, of course, is everything is connected. But to try to take a little piece of it, when under the framework uh, you know, there's a framework that I like very much called the right to the city. The people who contribute to the development of the city through their labor, through their cultural production, actually have the right to enjoy and to plan the city, and basically have their communities have a right to power. And using that frame, and I think that national coalitions like the Right to the City Coalition and many others have been very good on this, it becomes not just a housing issue. So the right to the city also means the right to be able to walk to your corner store in safety and with the reasonable expectation that you will not be killed by the police on your journey. It also means it also means the expectation that our schools are going to actually educate people regardless of their economic status. It certainly means approaches to creating a feminist city, a feminist city where women have the same expectation of safety in the city as men, and that we have appropriate kinship and family arrangements that are feminist influenced. So so the women can fully participate and enjoy their cities as well. So certainly around ableism, it certainly means making sure that our cities are developed in a way that that all people can enjoy and be mobile in it, and that all of these things, or most of these things rather, mean public investment. It means shifting priorities around from privatization and profit to actually investing in our cities once again.
What strengths and limitations do you find to using the, quote, human rights, unquote, framework around housing?
Well, what I like about using the framework of human rights is that it's a very simple concept. If you're human, you have the right to housing. Right. If you're a human, you have the right to safety, and you have the right to education and to appropriate income, to living wage jobs, and if you can't work, to having appropriate income support. So the frame of human rights cuts through this neoliberal crap that we're taught that there's many exceptions, that hey, you weren't personally responsible enough, you have too many kids, you weren't ambitious enough to get a good paying job, you're just cleaning houses. We constantly hear the excuses of why people did not deserve housing, and a human rights framework tells a very different story. It says that if you're a human being, you deserve safe and decent housing, and in a wonderful neighborhood. That's why the human rights frame is extremely useful. And of course, just like anything else, the idea of human rights can get very vague. It can be exploited by people that we don't agree with, and it can also be used very rhetorically. A liberal city could pass a resolution saying that it believes that everybody has the human right to housing, and then do nothing to actually fulfill that right. But I think that in balance, a frame of the human right for housing is quite useful.
One thing that we didn't get to so much during the conversation was some of the ecological environmental justice things that you talk about in the book. And one of the things that I found quite interesting was the way that certain land trusts in the U.S. affect change, end up facilitating the population that's living on the land trust or investing into the land trust into actually working to mitigate past environmental destructions that have been affecting the population living there. Can you talk about that a little bit? Does any spring to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert on environmental politics, but I just go back to my previous statement. Is when when people are secure in their land tenure and they're secure in their in their employment, then people will not be not be tempted to support environmentally degrading initiatives that go on in their community. And when they have the power to actually develop alternatives through community land trust, then all things are possible.
Well, thank you so much. We've been speaking with James Tracy, who is a longtime Bay Area-based housing activist and author, about his recent book, Dispatches Against Displacement, Field Notes from San Francisco's Housing Wars, which was just released from AK Press. Thanks a lot for chatting.
Thanks a lot.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can reach out to us for comment at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. After this segment from Sean Swain, you'll hear our interview with James Tracy on struggles around housing access, displacement, gentrification, and resistance in San Francisco.